I'm Hal Eisner, and this is What the Hal? And you know what I've been interested in for a long time, actually since I was a kid, is astronomy. Not so much the super scientific-y sort of astronomy, but really looking up at the skies, talking about planets and things like that, and reading up on them. It really is fascinating to me. Well, lucky me, being in the news business and being in Los Angeles, I have actually been able to make some connections in the space business. I have friends that work at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and I actually have a friend who's a space shuttle astronaut. How cool is that? Maybe we'll get him in here on one of these podcasts soon. Back to JPL. They recently were involved in a launch, a rocket launch from Southern California. Now, that's somewhat unusual. Usually it's from Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral, but not usually Southern California. However, we do have Vandenberg Air Force Base out here, and we have had launches out here. SpaceX often sends up its Falcon 9s from Vandenberg Air Force Base, and NASA recently did too, and one of the people behind that JPL mission is with us right now. Troy Hudson is with JPL and NASA and very involved in the InSight exploration program. Tell us about this program that's based on dealing with Mars.
Yeah, so InSight is NASA's next mission to Mars, and it's part of the Discovery program. This is a competed program. NASA has a pot of money, and they say, propose a mission to go do planetary science. InSight, through several rounds of competition, won that funding, and we have been working since around 2010, 2012 timeframe to produce this new lander. And InSight's primary goal is to understand Mars as a planet. We have sent spacecraft to look at the atmosphere, spacecraft to look at the surface, but there's a lot of deep questions we have about the core, the mantle, the overall structure and evolution of the planet, and how it compares to Earth and other rocky planets in the solar system. So,
what is this lander capable of doing?
So, first off, there is the actual landing on Mars. It has, and the cruise stage that goes with it, has the ability to bring it through space down to the surface of Mars safely. Once it's landed, it provides power to the instruments, and it has a robotic arm. One of the key elements, and a unique or a first-time element for the InSight, is we have instruments that must be picked up off the spacecraft and placed on the ground. Oh. So the robotic arm will pick up a seismometer, which will listen for Mars quakes. Best place to do that is on Mars. And even when you've landed, you're still a meter away. You still have to make that last little trip with the arm to the surface.
And I should say something. You are a planetary geologist.
By training.
We didn't really say that off the top. And that's very significant. That's a really interesting job, because if you were an Earth geologist, we know what you would be doing. But now as a planetary, your focus is in the heavens.
It's the same thing, the same processes of geologic formation and change. The same laws of physics apply everywhere. We're just looking at it on other planets.
So what is it we know about quakes on Mars?
We see that there are faults on the surface, so we expect that Mars has quakes. We have predictions about where it falls, sort of somewhere between quiet spots on Earth and the Moon, for instance. These are two places where we've put seismometers before. Earth has tons. The Moon had some from the Apollo program. We've never put a seismometer on the surface of Mars that has unambiguously been able to operate and detect Mars quakes. And so we have predictions, but Mars could always surprise us.
Why is it important to know if Mars has quakes?
So quakes, or even anything that produces that much energy released at a single moment, that energy moves through the planet. And as it moves through, it reflects and refracts. It's kind of like using ultrasound on your body. You can see inside something that you can't, you know, see with your eyes using sound. And you can think of quakes and their energy like sound. And they move through Mars. We can detect them. And by making models of Mars, we find out what model matches the data best, what structure, what layers, what thicknesses of layers, and what minerals best describe the interior of the planet.
How long does it take to get to Mars?
Depends on when you go and how you go. InSight will be launching at an ideal time where Earth and Mars are in the right place to let you get there in about 6 months. But if we miss this opportunity, we have to wait another over 2 years for Mars and Earth to get into the right place to do this again.
Wow. So the importance of this mission, I hear Mars quakes.
Well, there are three primary investigations for InSight. There's using the seismometer to start to do the structure of the planet with Mars quakes. There's a heat flow probe. This is something that will measure the amount of heat coming out of the interior of the planet. And heat is really the energy that drives geology. It's the energy behind volcanoes. It's ultimately the energy behind plate tectonics and quakes. This is a key feature of any planet now, and we can use it as a window looking back into the past of the planet. And then there's another experiment where we look at the spin of Mars and how it wobbles in space. And that can tell us about the core, its size and density.
But is this like chapter one of a 50-chapter book before we ever get to doing more sophisticated things on Mars or putting people on Mars or anything like that?
So part of this mission is to understand rocky planets in general. So Earth, we know Earth pretty well, but Earth is a very dynamic place. It's evolved a lot since it first formed. Lots of recycling and evolution of the mantle and the crust. Mars, being smaller, hasn't gone through quite as much. So it's kind of a window back into Earth's past. And that's one of the major scientific goals of this mission. I wouldn't necessarily say it's specifically related to humans going to Mars, but understanding how Earth forms, understanding how Mars forms, might let us know how common Earth-like planets are around other stars. So we only have four examples of rocky planets in this solar system.
They are?
Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. Maybe the Moon, but it's a bit of an oddball.
Funny to use the term oddball.
For sure. But we've discovered a lot of planets around other stars already, and we can't see them as well as we can see the ones here, but all the ones in our solar system, they all form from the same stuff. The same solar nebula came together and made these planets. Why are they so different? What features are necessary for life? Earth has plate tectonics, recycles things. That's good. It has a strong magnetic field that protects the atmosphere from the sun, the solar wind. Also good for life. Mars had a magnetic field in the past, but it lost it. It was too cold. It froze up. So understanding how rocky planets evolve could tell us more about how common life might be in the universe.
You know, it's interesting to me, you and I have talked before, about what intrigued you as a child growing up.
Mm.
What sent you in the direction of wanting to be a scientist?
Yeah, I was given a lot of opportunities to catch my interest. And when I was growing up in the late 70s and early 80s, there was Voyager, both Voyager 1 and 2, doing its grand tour of the outer solar system, giving us our first ever real pictures, close-up pictures of Jupiter and its moons and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. Fascinating. The space shuttle program, first launched in 1980, also really exciting from the perspective of sort of frontier exploration. And Carl Sagan's Cosmos series. My mother was a big fan. I saw it a lot as a kid, and it really inspired me to study space, science, rocks. These things have been part of me since I can remember.
Yeah. You know, Carl Sagan, and you and I talked about this earlier, I met him over at JPL. And I asked him about, do you think there's life out there in the universe? And his answer to me was, you'd have to be made of wood not to believe that there's life in the universe. And, you know, that kind of struck me as an interesting response. I mean, obviously, he feels there's stuff out there. Obviously, you must feel there's stuff out there.
The universe is a big place. And the more we learn about it, the more unusual and fascinating. There's so many different ways the same physical laws can create rocks and atmospheres and life. It happened on Earth. We really don't know yet whether it has ever occurred anywhere else, in our solar system or elsewhere. Personally, I think it's likely, but there's a lot of hope behind that. But Carl's right. You know, if it's just us, it might be an awful waste of space.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it is interesting to me that from our earliest years, we were fascinated with the heavens and the stars and the moon and all that sort of thing. And some people like you get engaged in a career of it. And others of us just kind of look out into the skies and wonder. But it is remarkable. We're just a little thing in the middle of a great big space.
We all have the ability to wonder about the universe we inhabit. Even on Earth, there's so many things that are beautiful and interesting. And for me personally, the more I understand about something, the more I can appreciate its beauty. But there are so many things that I don't understand, but I still find them utterly fascinating.
Do you have a goal? I mean, do you have something that someday you hope you can do?
I'm doing what I want to do right now. I am helping, or I'm part of the expansion of human knowledge, the exploration of the frontier, and really down into the nitty-gritty of it. I like working on the engineering problems for building and, you know, designing and testing instruments that will go off to another place and collect the data, the information that scientists will use to answer the questions and come up with new questions. That's my goal, and I'm doing it.
Of course, we learn from the past, and in the past, we've had tragedies. We had the Challenger disaster.
I was in second grade, and I was watching it live.
Still in your mind?
It changed my direction. I was always interested in science, but after that moment, I actually investigated a number of other pathways, oceanography, botany, archaeology. I kind of dabbled in interest. Of course, I was in elementary school and middle school, so just reading as much as I could and learning. And then I actually went to space camp summer after my freshman year of high school.
That must have been fun.
It was. It was a lot of fun. Not quite like the movie, but it was still very entertaining and very engaging. I went two more times, and you know, even after the first one, I was like, no, this is it. I want to do something that has to do with space. This is my first love.
You know, over the years, I've been lucky enough to meet astronauts and scientists and people like yourself, and I'm always fascinated. My takeaway is always, how can a mind get its arms, talk about a mind and arms, but how can a mind get its arms around the vastness of what space is all about?
It's something that's been part of the way I've thought about the universe and my place in it for quite a long time. So I guess you could say I'm used to it. To actually do the work, though, the work that I do, and to build something that can survive the rigors of the space environments and collect the correct data to answer the questions you want, there's a whole lot of detail work. Devil's in the details to the nth degree with space. Because once it leaves, you can't touch it again.
Right.
Everything has to be perfect.
Right.
So you can get kind of bogged down and just kind of browbeaten with all of the minutiae and the processes and the procedures for making a space mission happen. But it's all necessary because it's a high-risk endeavor and it's expensive. And, you know, you don't get that many opportunities to do it. So you want to make sure you do it right.
And you're doing it to learn about your neighbors in space, but you're also doing it to learn about ourselves, about our history, about how we were formed, about how our planet came to be.
Absolutely.
And the possibility of life in the universe.
I mean, even learning about, you know, Earth itself, getting a different perspective. This is like the Virgin Galactic folk. You know, they want to take people up into space, even if it's only for a few minutes, to give them a different perspective of the planet. Well, from a scientific, you know, viewpoint, you get a different perspective looking up from above, and you can see, you know, how things fit together in context. And there's the context of the Earth, and there's the context of the solar system, the galaxy, the universe. It all fits together.
It's huge. It's a lot of stuff. And I want to ask you about other planets because, you know, it's just not the moon and Mars. I mean, there's other stuff out there. And do you see, what kind of exploration do you see down the pike for some of these other planets out there?
Sure. There are a number of targets that the community of planetary scientists come together and they do a thing called a decadal survey. And there's a number of different organizations that do this.
Decadal or detail?
Decadal. So decadal. On a 10-year time scale.
Oh.
And it's a process that takes a year or so, but basically we bring in opinions and information from the entire science community and say, you know, what are the big questions? What are the things that we really want to get at in the next 10 years. And one of these came out in 2012, and it was talking about, you know, studying asteroids, studying Venus, studying the ice giant planets like Uranus and Neptune. These are sort of big goals. And there's a whole bunch of goals. There's so many questions to answer. So there are a lot of missions in the works there are missions that are flying now, like Juno around Jupiter. Cassini just finished its big mission at Saturn. So there's a lot of things, even within our solar system, that are worth exploring. And then there's all the stuff outside the solar system, like the Hubble Space Telescope and the other observatories are looking at.
A lot of this, though, does get down to that existential question of life. Why do we exist, right? Why do we exist? And do other forms of life, even micro types of life, microbial life would be the term, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, the most, if we were to find life elsewhere in our solar system, either extant or from the past, like, fossilized or something, it would probably be, microbial, single cellular organisms, because that's how life on Earth was for most of our history. Earth's been around for 4.5 billion years. We've only had multicellulars for 500 million years. So like maybe a tenth of the time. The rest of the time, it was bacteria and algae. So that's probably the most common form of life in the universe, if it even formed anywhere else. Life is a complicated thing, and how it actually began is something that we don't have a strong handle on yet.
You talked about things being looked at in decades, in periods of 10 years at a time.
Mm-hmm.
What are we looking at 10 years down the road?
Some of the things that are in the current decadal survey for planetary science is understanding Venus, because Venus is sometimes called Earth's twin. And of course, we know that it's very much unlike Earth. It's super hot. It's got a super dense atmosphere, but it's about the same size. And it's not just the distance to the sun that makes it different. And we want to understand why. What is it about Venus that makes it so different from Earth? So that's a key exploration target. Juno is currently exploring Jupiter, and it's telling us a lot of things that we did not know before.
Like what?
The core of Jupiter, there's actually a solid core there, but it's not fully solid. It's partially dissolved. And that's something that's totally unexpected.
And exciting for scientists.
Of course. Every time that you come across something that you can get answers to the questions you have, but in that process, you always get more questions. That's the beautiful thing about science. And we're discovering all these cyclones in the polar regions of Jupiter, which is very different from what we saw at Saturn. Why? There's so much why. There's so many questions.
It's interesting. When I've been over at JPL, especially on missions, and a mission is successful, and we're in Von Karman Auditorium, and all of a sudden this incredible cheer goes up. This incredible, everybody's dancing almost, because of the thrill of success. Well, that's because for years and years, many of you are dealing with minutiae. You're dealing with the itty-bitty sort of teeny-weeny piece of information that gets you to the bigger piece of information, that gets you to the bigger one. But every little itty-bitty thing is an important morsel, right?
Absolutely. And it's those little morsels, those little pieces of data and little observations that add up, which is actually the purpose of the mission. Those key moments, those critical moments of landing on Mars or entering orbit around another planet, those cheer moments, they're very important. They're very exciting. But so much of the mission that happens is a slow and steady collect the data, understand it, tell the spacecraft to do something a little different, get more data, and build up a picture over time. It's a slow process, building the mission and then taking the data and doing the science.
So getting back to the InSight mission, how long will InSight be on the planet?
So the mission is designed to operate for one Mars year. That's about 2 Earth years.
24 months?
Mm-hmm. So it's a solar-powered mission, and it's going to be landing near the equator, so it's always going to have a lot of sun to operate with. So we designed ourselves to survive for one Mars year. But if our indications with past spacecraft are any clue, like the Opportunity rover, designed for 90 days on Mars, recently celebrated its 5,000th. So InSight on the surface, and it's a lander, not a rover, it doesn't move around, it could be sending data back for a decade.
Wow. Wow. So you've got a little job security here, don't you?
Well, I am part of the InSight science team. Once the spacecraft lands and the instruments are deployed and they get into all their positions, the seismometers listening for Mars quakes, heat flow probes measuring the heat, once those things have happened, the science team will continue to collect those morsels of data and understand and revise their models of Mars. In my engineering capacity, I'll be moving on to work on some other instruments, some new opportunities for answering questions elsewhere.
After InSight does what InSight is supposed to do, what would be the next thing you want to do on Mars?
Well, any scientist you ask that question to will probably give you a different answer, because there are people who are interested in the deep interior. There are people who are interested in the atmosphere and the surface. Curiosity rover that's there now is exploring a place on Mars that may have had, or does, has had, we have shown that it has had, you know, liquid water standing on the surface in the past. And that liquid water on the surface, conditions for life as we know it, Jim.
Yeah. You know, Curiosity was named by a Midwest young lady named Clara Ma. And Claire and I have been friends ever since we did an interview years ago about her choosing the name Curiosity for the rover. It was a contest, everybody. It was a contest, name the rover. And Clara sent in the name Curiosity, and it won. And of course, this rover has been phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely. Curiosity, when it was originally directed by NASA for JPL to build this very capable rover, it was called the Mars Science Laboratory, and then they have held the competition to name it. InSight's name was more internally chosen. It's a bit of a pun on like going inside the planet, but also insight into the growth and evolution of planets, not just Mars, but Earth as well, and other rocky planets.
Just tell me one thing. Why do we care if there are earthquakes on Mars? I mean, okay, so let's say there are earthquakes, the ground moves, so what?
The earthquakes are, or the Mars quakes, are a source of energy. And that energy is what rings the planet, what shakes the planet, makes the vibrations. It's like that ultrasound analogy
I used before. Right.
The ultrasound, you know, injects energy, vibrations into your body, and then looks at the reflections. So we don't have big, you know, hammers to throw at Mars to make it shake and ring like a bell. It does that itself. Not just Mars, but there are also meteorites. One of the things that the seismometer will be able to hear are meteorite impacts, and we know that those are happening today.
Hitting the planet.
Yeah, we've taken pictures from orbit, and every now and then we'll see a new dark spot. We go zoom in on it, and look, oh, there's a brand new crater that just formed. Well, the seismometer will be able to hear that as well.
That's very exciting stuff. Look, if there are any young people who are listening to us and have a thought about wanting to do what you do for a living, what would you say to them?
Well, I mean, the whole the realm of science and math and technology, I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can pursue careers in that. You know, going to school, undergraduate, and then, you know, going to advanced degree levels, and also working as, you know, getting internships with, you know, NASA centers or other, you know, universities and research centers, you know, getting out there and getting experience in the field.
But there are some careers that just their time has come, and some careers their time is gone. And in science, I talk to my son about this all the time. He's in computer science. This is a good time for that.
I don't think the need for science or technology will ever go away. And there's the need for you know, fundamental research, understanding the laws of the universe and how those laws are expressed, such as geology. And then there's the technological side, things, everything from, you know, making better, you know, electronics to go into cell phones to making our quality of life on Earth better, being able to use less energy, being able to recycle materials. There's all sorts of things that different fields of science, whether it's engineering, applied sciences, or whether it's pure scientific research, they're all connected, and they can all, and you find the thing that fascinates you and follow that path. And there may not be a single path. There may be multiple ways to get there.
And so many other things come from our exploration. I mean, even something as simple as solar blankets. You know, there's frozen food, freeze-dried food, right?
The GPS in your phone even the camera in your phone. These are all things that had their original applications may have been cumbersome or expensive, but over time and as they have evolved and, you know, needs for them have developed, and we all reap the benefits.
All right. Well, we're going to be watching InSight for quite a while. And insight might excite.
Mm-hmm. It surely will.
It surely will.
Yeah.
All right, very good. Thank you, Troy.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right, very good. You know, right now is a great time to take a look at Mars. It's closest to the planet Earth, closest to us. And it's really a spectacle to take a look at some of the majestic planets and things we have up there in our universe. Now's a good time to be able to subscribe to What the How, to our podcast. Just go to iTunes or Google Play, any of the podcast platforms, and subscribe. And maybe make a nice positive comment and give me 5 stars so that we can also get some of that notation on those platforms as well. Well, look, bottom line is that if you're interested in space as much as I am, look to the sky. Yeah, it's great stuff up there. What the How. See you later.